alien or otherwise, ever recorded. There's just nothing like it. The new parents were not prone to exaggeration, but Molly couldn't help but be filled with skepticism. It didn't sound like reality at all, but something they'd lifted from one of the stories they used to read her at bedtime. So where exactly is this archaeological marvel? Molly asked, expecting more hyperbole. Young leaned back with a slightly conspiratorial grin. It's a place called Onyx. Chapter 3. What the hell is that? Spartan Tom B-292 shouted as the UNSC Pelican he was riding in arced high over what had become a full-on battle zone inside Onyx. He pointed down at a massive structure looking something like a giant stainless steel skull that had been flattened out with a hammer to the size of a small town. It sat half-buried in the top of a once grassy hill that had been decapitated as part of an archaeological dig. A dozen smaller figures cast in the same metallic style stood arrayed around it, blasting away at a scattered pack of archaeologists who were cowering behind whatever cover they could find. Tom recognized them right away as Forerunner Armigers, robotic soldiers programmed by a long-dead alien race to protect their artifacts from other people, which apparently included the archaeologists. The Armigers carried energy rifles powered by the same high-tech source that emitted a reddish glow through their eyes. "That's a lot of our people getting their asses kicked," Spartan Lucy B-091 shouted in response. Tom had to admit she was right. If they didn't get down there fast, there wouldn't be any civvies left to save. He hated leaping into an environment he didn't understand, though. "Not them. The big guy." "The sculpture?" Lucy asked, confused. "If that's what it is." "According to the briefing, which you clearly didn't read, how did you have the time?" The ramp opened up on the back of the Pelican, and Lucy started edging toward it. Tom followed right behind her. "That's part of what the researchers call Project Goliath," Lucy said. "They've been cropping up all around the galaxy lately, and a couple have even come alive and started moving around on their own." Tom popped on his helmet and squinted at the one below them. "This one looks pretty damn buried." "For now. But that's not our problem at the moment. These Armigers crawled out of the ground earlier today and have been trying to shoo our researchers away. With their weapons." Tom hefted his assault rifle. "We have a solution for that." Lucy smiled at him and then fitted her helmet on and checked the action on her assault rifle too. "We are the solution for that." She leaped out the back of the Pelican and let the jump jets embedded in the back of her Mjolnir armor slow her fall. Tom went right after her. They hit the ground running and started taking down Armigers straight away. They had fought such machines here before. More times than Tom cared to count. That went all the way back to the first time they'd been stationed inside Onyx, with Spartan Kurt 051 training the Spartan 3 Gamma Company. Back then, the machines had outnumbered the Spartans by exponential numbers. This time around, although there were 6 Armigers for every Spartan, the odds didn't bother Tom a bit. This they could handle. The Forerunner soldiers seemed to have come to some kind of tacit détente with the UNSC forces inside Onyx over the past few months, almost as if they'd simply agreed to ignore the people who'd taken up residence there. Something about getting too near the Project Goliath site, though, had apparently set them off. Fortunately, it hadn't triggered the appearance of a full-fledged army of them. "Watch your 9!" Lucy shouted. Tom spun to his left and gunned down a pair of Armigers who'd been charging straight at him. She spun to her right and did the same. Although Tom didn't talk about it much, he actually enjoyed this sort of dance. He and Lucy had performed this choreography so often over their years working together, since they'd been kids, that little felt more natural to him. The rhythm of their feet, the bullets, and even their reloads all seemed in perfect sync. Behind his helmet's polarized face shield, he smiled. In a handful of moments, it was over. The Armigers had all been blasted to pieces, and Tom and Lucy had sustained little more than a few scorch marks on their armor. Lucy scanned the horizon for more trouble on the way, while Tom motioned for the grateful archaeologists to head for the Pelican, which had landed a short walk nearby. As they filed up the ramp and into the safety of the aircraft, Tom reported in. "Chief," he said into his comm, "all clear. Looks like we got here in time. The diggers had no major casualties."
"Glad to hear it. Good work," Director Franklin Mendez said on the other end of the comm. "And that's Director Mendez these days."
"Right," Lucy chimed in. "Doesn't look like the Armigers damaged it at all. If anything, it seems like they were trying to protect it." "Any sign of life in that damn thing?" Mendez asked.
"Negative, Chief," said Tom.
The old man breathed something between a weary groan and a sigh of relief.
"For all our sakes, let's hope it stays that way."
Chapter 4. Not long after Young dropped the name Onyx and provided a handful of new details, Molly's new parents received an important call over the comm from their director, probably connected to the relocation. Molly retreated to her room for the rest of the afternoon, trying to process what they had told her. Beyond the name, she didn't have any details, but if she was honest, she wasn't sure she wanted to. Molly was not exactly thrilled about moving, especially off-world, and she wasn't planning on being shy about telling Asha and Young. Most of her life had been about adjusting to a move. She was tired of it. But where they wanted to take her? That was what caused Molly the most concern. The idea of living at some UNSC research site inside an enormous forerunner sphere the size of an entire solar system? That part was worth her revulsion alone. Even if Earth wasn't the safest place in the galaxy, at least it wasn't a 100-millennia-old forerunner installation, where you walked on the interior surface like the inside of some strange alien shell, and thousands of scientists were trying to figure out what it actually did, in case it went completely bad and killed them all. At first, Molly objected that there wouldn't be any place for her there, but Asha and Young assured her that wouldn't be the case. In fact, there'd be more residents in their research site at Onyx than in all of Aranuka. Oni had been there for years and had already constructed a large-scale research colony that had all of the workings of a major metropolis, something Asha referred to as state-of-the-art in civil engineering and urban infrastructure. This new city would apparently house thousands of researchers and their immediate families, all in brand-new homes as fine as those in any urban colonial site. It had shops, restaurants, gyms, and all the other trappings of civilian life. Even if the city was set on an artificial world holding a star at its center, something Molly had a hard time conceiving. From what Asha and Young had told her, the city inside Onyx had only been around for 5 years, and existed alongside remarkable forerunner living facilities and structures, something that had never before been managed in human history. They even had a school with others Molly's age, with larger classes than those she'd grown used to on Aranuka. This came as a shock, albeit a pleasant one. But that's when her new parents dropped a bombshell. This one was the most difficult to fathom, and it made Molly livid. Humanity wasn't living there alone. Onyx had aliens, too. Sangheili, Ungoy, both ex-Covenant species. This wasn't a complete surprise, but it didn't feel right to Molly and probably never would. The logic was pretty straightforward. Who better to help Oni research the Forerunners than former members of the Covenant? After all, the Covenant had evidently studied and worshipped the Forerunners as gods for generations. That had been the whole premise for their war against humanity, or so the story went. Ultimately, the Covenant had been entirely wrong about the Forerunners, which had led to a massive civil war in their ranks. According to the news feeds, they called it the Great Schism, a shocking split that helped the UNSC win the war against the Covenant. In any case, the facts were pretty straightforward. These species had spent more time researching and reverse-engineering Forerunner artifacts than any human ever had. To Oni, working alongside them was a necessary evil.
but the thought of living next door to such creatures, much less actually going to school with them, made Molly sick to her stomach. Their kind had been responsible for nearly 30 years of brutal warfare, some of which she had experienced firsthand, some of which she still had nightmares about. This would be different, Asha and Young had tried to assure her. There were supposedly good Sangheili who had worked under the leadership of the Arbiter, the alien warrior who'd formed an alliance with humanity to put an end to the Covenant after discovering the truth about the Forerunners. A number of other alien species had evidently flocked to his banner, and along with the legendary Spartan, the Master Chief, helped overthrow the Prophets, the group of aliens who had led the Covenant. This band of Sangheili eventually became known as the Swords of Sanghelios, the name of their homeworld. These Sangheili warriors now worked alongside humanity for the purposes of peace, or so the new parents had explained. To Molly, though, all that background was irrelevant. The fact that she'd have to live alongside aliens was enough for her to outright refuse to go. She would most definitely put up a fight. And after what had happened on Paris 4, who could blame her? Molly and her new parents ate dinner in silence that night, in part because she was still trying to absorb everything Asha and Young had told her. Also, in part, because there was no way in hell she was going to live next door to the monsters who had murdered her family. Once the meal was over, though, they adjourned to the living room again. Okay. Molly readied her opening salvo. You said it was safe. How do you figure that? Especially with ex-Covenant there. She tried to hold back any frustration in her voice, although she was pretty sure she'd failed. If it's the most important Forerunner asset in the entire galaxy, and Oni's classified it and is doing everything they can to understand it, then someone else is sure to want it, right? Young spoke first, with an even tone. It was the linguist in him. He would try to socially engineer the situation, because he thought if he could find the right words, he could make any problem go away. Molly, you don't have to stay there any longer than you want. After you turn 18, you're legally an adult and can make your own choices about where you live. Until then, we're your legal guardians, so you have to come along with us. Legal guardians? Molly shot back. What about what's right for me? What about what's fair? Would it be fair for Young and me to give up the greatest professional opportunity of our lives? Asha said. Would it be right to walk away from the chance to help do humanity some serious good, potentially even save millions of lives? Can't I have a normal life without constant changes for once? Molly didn't care if she was raising her voice. What about something normal for me? It seems like every single time I get settled somewhere, something falls apart. I'm so tired of it. I just want things to stay the same. I want them to be normal. Look, Molly, we know our careers have taken a toll on you, Young said, still maintaining his composure. Change isn't easy, and you've seen more than your share of it, especially painful change. If this wasn't important, it wouldn't even be on the table. One of the main reasons this is the best possible opportunity for all of us is that unlike our current positions here, which are very temporary, this would not be. This would be a permanent and lifelong investment for me and Asha. And for you, it would be a life without having to worry about any more changes. This is what you need, Molly. And we obviously can't leave you behind. We need to do this. And you need to come with us. What if I found a family to take me out here? I'm 16. I'm not a kid anymore. I could come visit you, or you could come see me. Molly. It doesn't work like that, okay? You can't just zip in and out of Onyx like it's a run-of-the-mill spaceport. This place is serious. The research facility is top secret, and under the complete control of the UNSC, it's the only way they could guarantee the researchers' safety. People are not free to come and go as they please. So what you're saying is that if I go with you, I'm effectively just stuck there? Molly shrank into the couch she was sitting on. falling more into despair about the whole idea with each passing moment. There seemed to be no way out. Once again, her life was being completely uprooted by circumstances beyond her control. And it seemed as if no one really cared about that. Worse, she'd be forced to live around creatures whose kind had less than 10 years ago been bombarding the surface of Paris IV. "You make it sound like you'd be a prisoner," Young said, "but it wouldn't be like that." Molly folded her arms across her chest and suppressed a sob. "How so?" Young shrugged. "Onyx is a wonderful place, Molly. There's nothing like it in the galaxy. It's filled with things no one on Earth has ever seen before. Machines, creatures, technology, and many worlds worth of uncharted, unexplored territory. You would be one of only a handful of humans in all of history to have ever set foot on this world. That's a big deal. Sure, you can't just leave at the drop of a hat, but that seems like a small price to pay for an experience like this. It's the single greatest discovery of our species, period." "You're not getting it." "I don't want to be a linguist or an archaeologist," Molly finally snapped. "I don't want to be what you two are. I have other plans for my life." "We know," Asha said solemnly. "You've been quite clear about that for a long time now." "Just leave me here, then," Molly said through gritted teeth. "Can't you just release me into the foster care system or something? I'm 16 now. I could survive fine. Then I'd be in line to become a soldier when I turn 18. That's what I want anyway." "Molly, that's enough. It's out of the question, so I don't want to hear that kind of talk," Young said with an edge she'd rarely heard in his voice. "We're not going to abandon you. Ever. And I really wish you'd drop this fantasy about becoming a soldier." "Why's that?" Molly spread her hands wide. This wasn't the first time they'd had this argument, and it wouldn't be the last. "Didn't soldiers save us all from the Covenant? In fact, the only reason we're still here, and you can do the kind of work you do, is because soldiers fought those aliens off this planet. The only reason I'm alive is because a soldier came and found me." Asha and Young exchanged sad and frustrated glances for a long moment. Then Asha finally sighed and said, "Humanity needs all sorts of people to protect it, not just soldiers. Our work on Onyx, for instance, could unlock secrets to help protect everybody. Maybe even put an end to war completely. Think for a minute about the kind of power required to build something like Onyx. This is an installation the size of a solar system. There are secrets there that could keep humanity safe for thousands of years." "Or consider the alternative," Young said. "If people like us don't try to figure these things out. Imagine if some hostile group with a vendetta managed to unlock the secrets of a facility like Onyx first. Where would that put us then?" "The fact is that science is a vital part of humanity's efforts to defend itself," Asha continued. "Even if we still have soldiers. That's why the Onyx Research Project is being sponsored and overseen by the UNSC. The Office of Naval Intelligence knows this, and they intend on using Onyx and its secrets to prevent anything like the Covenant War from ever happening again." "That's what I don't get," Molly said. "Oni and the UNSC exist to fight wars. If they find a weapon on Onyx, they'd use it if they needed to, and you know that. And so you're just going to dig these things up for them?" It was a fair question, given Oni's reputation as a shadowy government organization with mercenary activities. But Molly knew she was crossing a line, effectively accusing her peaceable new parents of working for the people most inclined to leverage any discoveries they made in hostile, war-oriented ways. "Oni may be pulling the strings on our projects," Young said, "but we don't work for them directly, nor for the UNSC either. We are going to Onyx on a peaceful mission, for purely academic purposes. It has to be this way, especially given the different kinds of people we'll be working alongside. The UEG contracted researchers actually occupy a different territory inside Onyx, entirely separate from the Oni facilities," Asha said. "We'll obviously be working with Oni, but not for them. Like we mentioned earlier, will be working alongside the Sangheili and other species, and the UNSC is obviously reluctant to give them any kind of direct access to its own bases. That right there sounds like a perfect reason for me to not go then, she said, trying desperately to make her new parents see the light. To you guys, this is just another job. To me, it's a nightmare. Think about it for a second. This isn't just another project. You're asking me to live next door to the same monsters that killed my family. Molly shocked even herself with how raw it felt to say that. Most days, she didn't think about the destruction of Paris IV at all. She'd buried it deep in her heart, in a place that could only be reached by her. Asha and Young's proposition had reopened wounds she'd wanted to keep locked forever. To live with the same kinds of aliens who'd taken away her mother, father, and sister. That was too far. That should have been enough for them to say no to Oni, or to just let Molly do her own thing. They were being selfish after they had made the commitment of raising and taking care of her, given all of the things that had happened to her. A move like this should have been completely out of bounds. After a moment with her head down, Molly looked up and could see that Asha and Young wanted to come over and hug her. But they kept their seats. These are not the same beings who did that horrible thing, Young said, in an even yet sympathetic tone. Do you think Oni would ever let anyone like that into Onyx? Trust me, Molly. The people we're working with here are safe and like-minded, no matter their species. Every single one of the aliens who will be there comes highly recommended by the Arbiter and his Swords of Sanghelios first. Oni's got dozens of security filters to weed out any and all threats. They've likely been scrutinizing even our family for months as well. He's right, Molly, Asha said. No one gets in without Oni's sanctioning. Onyx is effectively impenetrable from the outside. And even if you're worried that some ex-Covenant terrorists might somehow find a way in, the UNSC has installed the toughest security protocol ever created. We've been told that they may even have an actual fire team of Spartans there. Spartans. Molly let that sink in for a moment. That news was a potential game changer for her. If Spartans were there, that meant a level of safety she could rely on. Even among aliens. Everyone knew about the UNSC's Spartans, the unstoppable super soldiers who had fought against the Covenant for nearly 30 years. Spartans were one of the only things that could stop the aliens during the war. They were the stuff of legend, and Molly's new parents knew, despite their reservations about soldiers, that if the Spartans had anything to do with Onyx, it would directly affect how she felt about the move. Molly took a deep breath and worked hard to get a hold of herself in the wake of her cathartic venting and this new information. After a long moment, she exhaled, forcing out as much of her fear as she could. Spartans did make this different, as much as she didn't want to admit it. All of this is beside the point, Asha said with welling eyes. We love you, Molly, and we're going to take care of you and protect you until you're old enough to live on your own. So this discussion effectively is over. You're going to come with us, because we couldn't live without you. Everything is going to be fine. I promise you that. Molly stared out the window at the encroaching dusk and frowned, taking in that promise as the sun sank to the horizon, as much as they said they wanted to hear her out. She knew that ultimately she had no say regarding what happened to her life, and that made her angry and frustrated. This had been her story since she was 7, and it wasn't going to change anytime soon. Do we really have to live side by side with aliens? Molly asked wearily. Asha slid off her chair and sat down on the couch beside Molly. A moment later, Young followed suit and slipped in on the other side. Together they leaned in and gave Molly a gentle hug. She fought the urge to embrace them in return, even though she wanted to. But she couldn't. Not yet. It still hurt too much. Yes, in a way. Perhaps not as neighbors, but there will be Sangheili there, Asha said soothingly. They're allies now, Molly. And they're all experts and scientists, too, not soldiers. They won't be a threat. I promise you.
I can't just forget Paris 4.
Young gave Molly a grim nod. Of course not. But even if the Sangheili were on the wrong side then, Molly, they're on our side now. These elites don't want war, just like us. That's why this research facility exists.
Yong had used the term the UNSC had dubbed the Sangheili after their first encounter, the same one most often heard in news feeds. Elites. Outside a few exceptions, the elites were the most effective warriors the Covenant had to offer, so it had been a fitting nickname at the time, especially since the two species had been introduced by way of weapons rather than words. Molly leaned into Yong.
I don't know if that makes me feel a whole lot better.
Asha squeezed her shoulders. You've read the reports. Without the Arbiter and the elites who pledged to help him, we'd have lost the war.
But what about the rumors of there being another Covenant? Like the group that attacked New Phoenix last year? Or any of the other hostile alien groups out there? Molly asked. The news feeds keep saying how dangerous they are. What if they found a way in?
Yong waggled his head slightly from side to side, half conceding the point.
You're right. There are elements that still exist, like the servants of the Abiding Truth, who continue to see the Forerunners as gods. And they're certainly a problem. That's probably why they've stationed Spartans on Onyx. Oni's not going to take any chances at all.
What Yong said earlier isn't an exaggeration, Molly. Asha said, Onyx is the safest place in the galaxy. There's no question.
You're more at risk here in Aranuka than you would be on Onyx, and that's a fact.
Molly sighed. If she was serious about not going with them, the only real option she had was to run away. But she couldn't see how that would work. Maybe she could disappear in a normal metropolis. But here on the empty and secluded Aranuka platform, surrounded by nothing but thousands of kilometers of open ocean on every side, there wasn't any place for her to go.
On top of that, she knew how much leaving her new parents would hurt them. Despite the pain she felt today, there was no way she could bring herself to inflict that on them, no matter where they wanted to take her. She couldn't just abandon them like that. Especially not after all they'd done for her. All the love they'd shown her. That was it. She'd have to move with them to Onyx. And she'd have to be a good soldier about it. Molly would follow orders and go along with their plan. For now, at least. But they couldn't make her like it. And they couldn't make her stay past her 18th birthday. So she would count the days and do the time. But the moment she got her proper legal chance to get free and clear of Onyx, on that day, Molly would leave without a second thought. And nothing they could say or do would keep her there a moment longer.
Chapter 5. Dural Mdama had long ago promised himself that he would avoid backwater planets like Hesduros if he could. The Sangheili warrior had spent enough time in such places during his short years, trying to avoid being captured by the Arbiter and his traitorous kind. And all along, Dural had wanted nothing more than to take the fight straight to them on his homeworld, Sanghelios. He also had no desire to become like many of his uncles, either to flee his keep in their ancestral homeland in Mdama, or to be slaughtered like a herd of helpless kolo in their pens. The young Sangheili had come of age in the dying days of the war with the humans, and he had survived those days only to watch his proud people become fractured, broken, and ultimately beaten. Dural vowed that he would not end up like them. Instead, he would do everything in his power to lead them back from the brink of irrelevance and to reclaim their glory. Yet Dural found himself on Song of Wrath, a heavily armed bark bearing down through the dense atmosphere of Hesduros, about to meet with a lowly Kaidon who was only valuable to him
because of a simple accident of fate.
But perhaps fate knew nothing of accidents.
From his seat at Dural's left hand, Shipmaster Buran Utaral, a battle-tested commander, signaled for his attention. Buran might have gone soft around the middle from spending too much time on a ship rather than on the field of battle, but he had lost none of the edge in his steely eyes.
"We are on our final approach to the province, Panam," the warrior announced. He added discreetly, "Are you sure this is our best course of action?"
Before Dural could answer, Rook Nusra snarled at Buran from the seat on the right.
"How dare you question the Pale Blade's judgment in front of the crew? We have been over this a dozen times. This may be a bold and daring choice, but if Dural M'Dama declares this to be our path, then may the gods bless it."
Dural quieted Rook with a sharp gesture. As the one they called the Pale Blade, he appreciated Rook's support, but he was more than capable of dealing with Buran himself.
"Do you doubt the judgment of Fieldmaster Avumed Telkam?" Dural asked the shipmaster.
"Never."
Buran put a fist to his chest in a sign of respect for their former leader's memory.
"But he is not the one who put us on this path."
"No. That was my decision," Dural said. "But he named me his successor as the leader of the Servants of the Abiding Truth. If you doubt my judgment, then you doubt his."
That Telkam had chosen one as young as Dural M'Dama over such stalwarts as Buran rankled the shipmaster. But not enough for him to ever challenge the Pale Blade of the leadership of the Abiding Truth. At least, not yet. The Fieldmaster's decision had surprised Dural as well. The Sangheili youth had loyally served him and the Abiding Truth since the day Telkom had taken him in more than 5 years ago. The Fieldmaster had been one of the last to see Dural's mother alive, as a passenger on his own starship during their failed siege against the Arbiter Thel Vedam, the battle that had launched what the Sangheili had come to call the Blooding Years. She had died while in Telkom's charge, and out of a sense of responsibility, the Fieldmaster had taken Dural on as his apprentice. M'Dama knew who was really to blame for his mother's death, however. The Arbiter himself, who had betrayed all of Sangheili's when he led so many of its people to join forces with the humans against the false prophets. If he had not sundered the Sangheili so, they might still have been victorious over the humans in the end. Instead, Dural's once proud people now found themselves so terribly reduced to weakness. For such sins, along with the death of his mother, Dural had long ago vowed that Thel Vedam would pay. This was the next step upon that quest. Buran looked away, unable to meet Dural's eyes.
"As the Pale Blade commands," he said sullenly,
using the name the young leader had earned on the field of battle. Some might have thought the designation an insult, a derogatory reference to Dural's pale skin, something that set him apart from many of his fellow brethren of Antum, Soravat, or Kaloabin, the lineages that formed the bulk of the servants. Dural, however, knew that it marked him as one not from the compromised lowlands and coastal city-states, but from the province of M'Dama, proud and indomitable since its birth. Dural M'Dama was not simply different from the others among the servants, though. He was better. Because of that, he had embraced the name, transforming it from insult into honorific, weaving a legend of terror into the hearts of all those who heard of his deeds. Many of the warriors of the Abiding Truth wore armor cobbled together from their time serving with the Covenant, improved with whatever pieces they could pick up along the way. They looked like militia soldiers, similar to those from the early days of Sangheili's. Most of them were too preoccupied with the function of their armor to see the practical advantage of instilling fear in the hearts of one's enemies as well. For himself, and at the urging of the Fieldmaster, Dural had painted the pieces of his own armor all in a pale blue, the color of an energy blade, His helmet and harness were of an anchorite warrior sect, a fierce and ancient variety he had recovered from the vaults of the Antom Temple, where the servants of the Abiding Truth were stationed. In many ways, Dural had fully become the Pale Blade. With his former history largely forgotten, others now spoke only of his skill on the battlefield. They easily set Dural apart from the rest, exactly as he had desired. The Sangheili rode in silence the remainder of the way down to the keep at the center of Panam, a small and remote township slung out across the edge of a densely forested region of Vakoro, a supercontinent in northern Hesduros. The detachment of warriors landed the bark just outside it and disembarked in formation. After their vanguard fanned out in advance of those in command, the Pale Blade took the lead, with Buron and Rook at his sides. A grizzled Sangheili, who somehow made Buron look like the peak of fitness, hobbled through the front gate of the keep to greet their command. He led a congregation of brow-beaten, poorly armed warriors from within the town. This was the Kaidan Panam, the Sangheili leader of the city-state of the same name, and as he limped toward the servants, Dural wondered why none of his own people had stepped forward to wrest control of the keep from him, upholding the ancient traditions. It was the noble thing to do to this old creature. He must have done much for them in the past to command such respect even now. Or perhaps they were merely all weaklings. "Greetings, Dural M'dama." The Kaidan tilted his head to the side to get a closer look at the young commander. "I would like to say I am pleased to see you here, but I think I have had enough of warriors from the line of M'dama for a lifetime." Dural favored him with an understanding nod as he surveyed the walls of the keep. Several sections had been obliterated with what appeared to have been plasma fire, recently enough that the people of Panam had not even had time to properly clear the rubble. "The Arbiter's arm has fallen heavily upon you." "True, but we would never have attracted the traitor's attention if I had not permitted Jewel M'dama and his allies within my walls. He may call himself the Hand of the Didact, but he has only drawn the hand of destruction to our people. His campaign against the Swords of Sangheilios brought the Arbiter's wrath down on us." "I understand this is why my uncle decided to abandon his many redoubts on this world, or what's left of them since the assault, and take the battle to the Arbiter's doorstep. He prepares for his assault on the contested states of Sangheilios, even as we speak." Dural had called Jewel his uncle, for that is how he had long known him, just as all the fledglings on Sangheilios called their older male relatives uncle. They might each know their mothers, but to prevent nepotism, they were all denied the knowledge of their fathers. Mostly. Panam scoffed. "Much good that will do my people. We few who survive." The warriors around him all nodded in grave agreement. "We have all lost much to the swords," Dural said, "and even more to their allies." Panam grunted. "I heard about the death of Avu Medtelkam. To be cut down like that by one of the demons, he is sorely missed." Dural appreciated the sentiment, but he had not come here to commiserate with Panam over losses. Panam sensed Dural's eagerness. "You have other concerns, I know." Panam craned his neck to see Dural's warriors continuing to pour out of the starship. "I'm afraid, though, that you've come here ready to start a war with a missing foe." "We are actually not here to fight on this world, and we do not need your help. We simply need access to the ancient portal that lies within your land." Panam scowled. "The same portal that brought Jewel M'dama to our home? What good would that do you? Are you fleeing from the Arbiter's forces yourself?" Rook huffed at that, clacking his mandibles together. "Such efforts will do you no good," Panam said, irritated. "Do you think we would not have used the portal ourselves if we could have escaped the sword's assault on our keep in that way?
It has not been active since the day Jewel Ndama arrived years ago. On our side, at least, it remains sealed.
Dural shook his head. To you, certainly, but not to me. Panon peered at the young warrior, now suspicious.
What fool's errand are you on, fledgling?
Dural didn't care for the condescending tone. He stretched up to his full height and did not seek to hide the anger building in his voice.
I aim to bring the fight to the Arbiter's clan and his human allies, so that we can avenge the death of our former leader, the esteemed Fieldmaster Avumed Telkam.
Panom shook his head at Dural in amazement.
I admire your ambition, but you have already run headlong into the first wall of your plan. The portal you seek will not open for you, for me, or for anyone else on this world. Your uncle had to coerce a Hurigok, one of the very servant tools of the gods, into opening it for him when he was on the other side. And as you can see, fledgling, I don't have any of those rare creatures in my employ.
Panom's warriors growled in assent. Dural motioned toward Song of Wrath's open bay door, and a squad escorted a blue and purple creature down the boarding ramp. It was roughly the size and shape of an Okadoth, a Sanghelios native soft-bodied aquatic animal, similar to the human's jellyfish, hovering a meter off the ground. Four prehensile tentacles dangled from its sides, languorously squirming about. Its head snaked out from the front of it on a sinuous long neck, and its eyes stared out from its glowing blue face, devouring every bit of its new environment.
How fortunate, then, Kaidon Panom, that I do.
Chapter 6
I'd like to personally welcome you all to Onyx, said the holographic projection at the end of the passenger cabin on board the UNSC Milwaukee. I'm Director Hugo Barton. He was communicating through some kind of real-time comm system, the attendant had advised earlier. Apparently he was speaking from his office on Onyx through a faster-than-light dimension called Wave Space. Admittedly, Molly was a little disappointed to see him appear there. Her family was on a UNSC starship heading for their new home inside this mysterious and ancient forerunner world, and she'd been hoping to be welcomed by someone or something a bit more exciting. It was not as if she were expecting to have someone such as the Master Chief greeting them. But her heart sank a little when a man who looked like an antiquated scientist or a mid-level bureaucrat popped up, rather than a war hero clad in a set of battle-scarred Mjolnir armor. For Molly, one of the only silver linings in moving to Onyx was the possibility of seeing a Spartan in person. She'd been nursing the hope that she'd run into at least one of them, maybe even on the way there. Nevertheless, Molly knew the director was probably more important than any particular Spartan in the grand scheme of Oni's operations, especially as it related to Onyx and its research facilities. Molly had never heard of the man, but that might have been a reflection of just how good he was at his job. The word about Oni was that one never heard an employee's name mentioned publicly, unless the person was in public relations or was dismissed, something that rarely happened. According to other more sensational rumors, termination, in the most lethal sense of the word, was how Oni usually let their employees go. Once you were Oni, you were Oni for life, whether you liked it or not. Director Barton was balding and pale, worn but determined. He wore a dark suit and tie, but seemed uncomfortable in both. This was clearly not his favorite part of the job. The man chose his words carefully as he spoke to the assembled passengers on the Milwaukee, a large Poseidon-class carrier that had been repurposed for shuttling facility personnel, civilians, and goods back and forth between Onyx and the rest of the galaxy. Young, Asha, and Molly were on board, along with a few hundred other people. Altogether, the passengers barely filled out half the transport's main cabin,
which had been fitted with comfortable, roomy stadium-style seating that let them all have an unobstructed view of the large display at the front of the cabin. When Molly had been rescued from Paris IV and transported to Earth, all she remembered was being strapped into a soldier's jump seat in a much smaller craft, and it had taken what felt like forever to get there. Part of that had likely been because she hadn't been allowed to go straight from Paris IV to Earth due to travel protocols. Taking the direct route would have left a trail in the ship's nav system, and made it far too easy for the Covenant to follow them back home and launch an attack directly against Earth. And no one wanted that. Not until a few years later did the aliens finally track down humanity's homeworld. The Milwaukee had been fitted with the latest slipspace drive technology, something reverse-engineered from some machines recovered on Onyx, Young had explained to Molly earlier. This would cut down on the ship's travel time substantially, which meant that the transport didn't need large stasis bays for cryo-storage, or even private berths for the passengers. Instead, Milwaukee had been fitted with enough comfortable seats for the several hours-long trip to their new home. This was a sharp departure from decades of extremely long space travel that had demanded harsher measures. Young and Asha, sitting on either side of Molly, each reached out to give her hands a gentle squeeze. She was not sure how, but they knew immediately what she was thinking. Evidently, she didn't mask her disappointment well.
I got confirmation from our contact back in Aranuka.
There's actually a full detachment of Spartans stationed on Onyx, Asha said with a knowing smile. You'll probably see them around all the time. They gave all authorized employees an extensive briefing on what to expect when we got there. This one is for everyone else. Molly sat back and took a deep breath to mask her excitement. She was going to see Spartans after all. She tried to focus her attention on what Director Barton said as a number of holographic spheres, representing a solar system, rose in front of his own projection. Even though he was speaking to many high-level academics, Molly could tell that Barton was keeping his explanation fairly simple, so that the rest of the people aboard the ship would be able to understand it.
You've reached the Zeta Doradus system, which puts you about 38 light-years from Earth. The fourth planet here was known as Onyx for decades, and the UNSC eventually used it as a large-scale research site and a training ground for Spartans.
Training? Molly wondered. Obviously, she knew the Spartans didn't just spring into existence, and she had read much of the published information about their augmentations and armor. But she hadn't given a lot of thought to how they had been educated or field-tested. It made sense that they would be trained for years in a classified location, forged into an unstoppable breed of soldiers before being deployed into the wild. A lot about their origins was kept shrouded in mystery, likely part of Oni's design, both to keep their cards close to their chest and to create an aura of formidability around the legendary heroes. As we investigated further, it turned out that Onyx wasn't a normal planet at all, Barton continued. Many years ago, when it was first discovered, Onyx was simply a remote but habitable world, and was even considered a good candidate for human colonization. When a number of forerunner structures were discovered on the surface, however, it was quarantined, and it underwent extensive research. That has only recently been declassified for you and your research teams. Molly knew this wasn't the full story. Even though everyone aboard the ship had been aggressively vetted with a dozen background checks and granted top-secret clearance to this realm of UNSC jurisdiction, she was completely confident that Oni still tailored everything it revealed to anyone, even its own employees. In fact, she would have been disappointed to learn otherwise. Toward the end of the war, Barton continued, the planet ended up tearing itself apart for reasons we have yet to fully understand. As it disintegrated, however, Onyx revealed that its physical mass had been composed almost entirely of Sentinels, the automated forerunner drones that many of you have already interfaced with in your research. In front of Barton's own projection hovered a holographic representation,
of a strange alien-looking machine with robotic sensors and grapplers, including a glowing series of lights on its central mass. Three large booming arms were connected to a larger chassis, with what appeared to be a firing mechanism fixed to its undercarriage. Molly wondered if that was intended to be its weapon. All that remained of Onyx after this cataclysmic event was a 23-centimeter object that had housed a secret slipspace enclosure for over 100,000 years. This enclosure was like an invisible pocket in real space, where things could exist completely outside reality. Literally. Within the enclosure was a massive Dyson sphere with a diameter roughly the size of Earth's orbit around Sol. All of this had been spatially compressed in slipspace, and then buried at the center of the world of Onyx since the time of the Forerunners. The sphere is called a shield world, as some of you already know. It was built by the Forerunners as a refuge, an immense shell-like construct, the interior surface of which resembles the surface of natural worlds. But this one spans 2 full astronomical units from one side to the other. It has some fascinating elements within it, at least now that the sphere has transitioned into real space. A scruffy-haired boy a few rows ahead gasped at this information, but his father shushed him before he could start asking questions about it. Molly had felt the same exact impulse, but she'd been able to control it. Whatever Onyx was, her new parents' description had not accurately painted the picture. She found it strange and slightly frustrating to begin feeling a genuine curiosity about something she had so vehemently protested. But there she was, looking forward to seeing this new place. We actually had UNSC personnel inside the sphere when it transitioned to real space, and while they were inside, due to a time dilation effect of the slipspace container, what had only been days and weeks for them passed as full months for those of us on the outside. That all changed when the sphere left the slipspace enclosure and physically entered real space with the rest of the galaxy. Actually, a number of other amazing things happened all at once. The previous hologram vanished, and a new one took its place. This one showed the sentinels that had formed Onyx dissolving away from the planet like a cloud of dust, and then it zoomed down to an impossibly small sphere that coursed with energy. It hung there in empty space for a moment, and then began to grow so fast it almost seemed as if it were exploding. First, of course, Barton explained, the sphere expanded out into real space, fully enveloping the star system it was in, Zeta Doradus. Obviously, it actually didn't change its size at all, just its spatial location. To give you a rough idea of what we're dealing with in terms of size, its interior surface area is the equivalent of 500 million Earths. Not all of it has been terraformed. In fact, evidence indicates its construction was never fully completed by its original architects. But a substantial percentage of the interior surface appears to be habitable. The image changed then to show the sphere swallowing the rest of the system's planets as it spread out rapidly to take up most of the star system. Molly realized that this wasn't how it had actually happened, but just a computer simulation. What really took place would have been too far beyond human comprehension for it to be clearly conveyed through images. Second, during its expansion process, the sphere gathered Zeta Doradus's 3 inner planets through a complex kind of gravitic system. It wove them into the vast space inside itself, and they now orbit around the Dyson sphere's own internal sun. Yes, you heard that right. It has its own sun, although we're not quite sure if it's artificial or was somehow pulled from another system. The data we have is inconclusive. Either possibility is plausible for the Forerunners, as some of you know, despite our inability to understand all of the mechanics at play. The sphere that represented Onyx now hung there in space, and a smaller star hovered next to it. Molly gasped at this. It was incredible to see an artificial structure utterly dwarf a star
that had fed an entire system of planets with heat and light. Third, the sphere's expansion path, precisely anchored to Onyx's original orbit, put it right alongside the system's real star, Zeta Doradus, in a stable and consistent orbit. Though significantly smaller than the sphere, the sun sits just outside the exterior of the shield world.
We're not exactly sure why or how this happened either, but one of the results is that Onyx is able to gather energy from the sun from a fixed siphon located on its outer surface. It's a pretty remarkable feat of engineering, even after years of seeing it in action.
A thin red-haired woman raised her hand to interrupt, but spoke before Director Barton could even acknowledge her. Doesn't it seem miraculous that putting these two massive objects into such an orbit didn't somehow tear one or both of them apart?
When it comes to the Forerunners, Barton said, miracles are a normal, everyday thing. Spend enough time on Onyx, though, and you'll quickly come to the conclusion that there's really no such thing as a miracle. Just science so advanced we can't currently comprehend it. But that's obviously where you fine people come in.
Molly glanced around the cabin. Her family was seated toward the rear so she could only see the backs of people's heads. Of the couple 100 people assembled, most were adults. But there were plenty of children, too, ranging from infants all the way up to teenagers her own age. She'd been watching some of them throughout the trip. Picking a researcher out of a crowd wasn't all that difficult, although this group was heavy on that vocation. Still, they stood out from the ship's crew and from the military personnel for all the reasons one would expect, generally because they weren't quite as fit, having spent most of their time on academic studies. They often seemed to be ruminating about something rather than paying attention to anything directly in front of them. They were obviously preoccupied with what lay ahead of them metaphorically instead, whatever they had been called to Onyx to do. And they always wore this look of wistful, dreamy anticipation, something Molly frequently saw with Asha and Young, especially recently. The researchers' companions, however, the normal people, as Molly thought of them, weren't quite as serene about all of this. To them, and to Molly in many respects, this voyage to Onyx was clearly less of a grand adventure and more like an ominous mystery. For most people, the Forerunners were a concept they had only recently become aware of, and they hadn't given much contemplation to advanced alien races doing good things, especially in the wake of the Covenant War. The idea that a species had existed 100,000 years ago and had created machines the size of worlds was understandably frightening on a lot of levels. Despite this, all of these people had been at least dedicated enough to their loved ones to accompany them on this voyage. But just like Molly, what choice had they? Many of them had probably been through knockdown, drag-out arguments like the ones she'd had with her new parents. How could they not have, Molly thought. That was a lot of misery and second-guessing to bundle into a single transport. But they all seemed to be managing it for the moment. She began to wonder how well that would last once they had all settled into their new houses, homes situated next to the same aliens whose species had spent the better part of the last 3 decades trying to eradicate humanity from the galaxy. No one would have even thought of such a thing during the war, and for some people, apparently only those rational and logical, such as Molly, the basic concept still seemed insanely dangerous. She was curious if anyone else in this room had ever seen a planet being glassed up close, as she had. "Are there any other questions?" the real-time projection of Director Barton asked. With that, at least 100 hands shot up, including Molly's. "I mean about the sphere itself," Barton said. The majority of the hands went down. "And I further mean, anything that I can answer quickly that might be of interest to the entire group." Most of the remaining hands slipped away this time. But not Molly's. She was one of only a few who persisted, and she realized she might actually get to ask the Oni director a question. She might finally get the answers she wanted, the ones she deserved. And then Director Barton nodded toward her. Molly almost choked. She had so many queries clashing in her head that she could barely figure out where to begin. For a few seconds, she just sat there in silence, before Young gently nudged her in the ribs with an elbow. She finally gave up trying to parse all of the different things she wanted to ask, and just blurted the first one that came to mind.
"Why is the sphere called Onyx?"